Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn. Another beautiful day, Mom.
Yeah, we're going to have some hot weather here coming pretty quick. We're having it already.
Yeah, 90 degrees.
It's almost summer.
It's supposed to be hitting today. I'm not thrilled about that.
Well, thank God for air conditioning.
That is true. I remember when you didn't have air conditioning.
Oh, you remember? I remember, too.
Well,
I lived in a big brick house, which was always hot.
Yeah, well, your bedroom had air conditioning. Our bedrooms did not. I don't know if you remember that part.
No, I don't think so. I don't think we ever had air conditioning.
You had a window air conditioner, yeah, out in Pennsylvania.
Oh, in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
I'm talking about Fairfield.
Oh. Well, let's get down to our book today. And
yes.
Our author.
Oh, yeah. Interesting book.
Yeah, and very timely for sure.
Yes, it is.
So our guest today is Brendan Keeley, and he's the New York Times bestselling author of All American Boys, written with Jason Reynolds, and they were on Writer's Voices some years back. I'm thinking that was maybe about 4 years ago.
About three years ago. I think it may be in 2015 when the book came out.
Okay, 3 years ago. And he's also written The Last True Love Story and The Gospel of Winter. His work has been published in 10 languages, received a Coretta Scott King Author Honor Award and many other awards. And he writes mostly for young adults. And he was originally from the Boston area, now lives with his wife in New York City. Welcome back to Writer's Voices, Brendan.
Oh, thank you so much. So glad to be here. And I don't know if we need to talk about the book at all. I'd rather just listen to the two of you. This is great.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, pretty soon we have our secrets.
Yeah, right. We have interesting stories. Yes, we do.
Well, Mom's got over 80 years worth of them, so.
Oh, my gosh. Hats off.
I'm trying to write some of them. I've written some of them down, some of my memories down, and it's good, you know. It's fun.
That's great.
So, Brendan, tell us how you became a writer for young adults.
Sure. So, it's two things that kind of come together. The first is, of course, that I wanted to write. And when I was working on, you know, I wrote short stories, and I was working on one novel, and that wasn't any good, and then I was working on another novel, and it changed, and it took time, and as I was working on all these things, slowly but surely, what eventually became The Gospel of Winter came together, and it was a novel that luckily an agent, my agent, Rob Weisbach, thought was a good project, so I was very excited. And very truthfully, we thought that the book was a book for adults, and that was the original intention. But then we started getting feedback saying, well, the narrator is a 16-year-old boy. It's in first person. This might really work well as a young adult novel. Simultaneously, I'd been working at a high school for what amounted to 10 years. So it made perfect sense that I would have the sensibilities to be writing, you know, at least in the voice of, if not also in the kind of worldview of teenagers.
Absolutely.
And so these two things came together, and as soon as we started pitching that first book out there in the world to young adult editors, there was a lot of interest. So it was a surprise and a very happy surprise, or as the Shakespeare line, happy accident.
right.
And I'm thrilled because I love young people, and now I've spent the last what now is 4 years in the young adult world, writing books for young adults and adults, but primarily focusing on the intersection between social justice and literature for young adults, and that's always where my heart really lies. So I'm glad to have been there.
So were you a teacher?
I did. I taught. I worked at a private school in New York. So I taught 10th grade English. I taught a whole host of electives. I also worked on the administrative side. I worked in communication and marketing, and I worked in fundraising 1 year. I bounced all around the school, and I said there are only a couple of positions left, and the head of school, which I was never going to do, or working in the kitchen, which is what I really wanted to do because I love food.
Well, I was a high school teacher too, so.
A high school English teacher, in fact.
Yeah, what did you teach?
Yeah. Oh, gosh, well, I taught 10th grade English, and I also taught sociology. Yeah, and I had a couple of remedial classes, and those were interesting. And I had a whole gamut of things, and it made it. And I was also the yearbook advisor, so
wow. So
I had quite a time.
Sorry. Yes.
I just wanted to mention that I don't know if I ever said the title of our book today, which is Tradition is Not an Excuse. And
yeah, well, actually, the title is Tradition. And the is not an excuse is a tagline on the cover, but I have to remind everybody that I'm speaking to about that, because the way that it looks on the cover, it looks like the title.
Tradition is set in a private school in New England, but the teachers in this book don't come off looking very good.
Well, there's one teacher I think who is a resource for some of the kids who really are looking for help. And as one reader shared with me, she said, you know, I really appreciated the character of the counselor, because she said my own daughter reached out to the school nurse, and the school nurse, it seemed like, sometimes was her best friend. And for me, as someone who was a teacher at a school where there were a whole host of kids with different kinds of needs, I remember those students who really did find that one teacher to latch onto, and so I want to make sure that there's a character like that in a book. However, mm-hmm. I agree, the rest of them don't look so good.
Yeah, well, I suppose they're just trying to hold on to their jobs.
Yeah, well... Yeah, I think that's a real consideration when what if the topic of conversation in the book, since it grapples with a culture that really enables and protects sexual harassers and assaulters, the the story is all too true in many environments, and I think a lot of people are afraid of having the conversation in the first place.
Yeah.
And therefore, when survivors speak up, I think a lot of people are just so afraid of the conversation, they don't even know how to be the best resources. And so I think that's also true. I don't want to throw everybody under the bus and say they're villainous. I think literally we just don't do a good job enabling productive conversation about some of the tough stuff. And so that's precisely why I write the novels that I write, to allow us an entry point into these necessary conversations, because the fact of the matter is, whether you're looking at one statistic or another, one in five or one in four women in the United States will experience sexual assault. And that means it's absolutely necessary that we're having these conversations and that we're not sweeping them under the rug. And I think novels are a great place to begin those conversations.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, a lot of us, in situations we encounter, we just keep our heads down and turn away. You know, that's what we do. And unfortunately, but now it seems like things are changing a little bit in the atmosphere, and that's a good thing.
The timing of this book is really interesting with the Me Too movement, you know, that kind of came to life just last year. Obviously, you had to be writing this significantly before that.
Yeah, I started working on the book. Well, I started working on the book a while ago in an earlier iteration, and. But I started working on the book in earnest in 2015, and so that was, you know, before the celebrities really helped bring the Me Too movement to light. I think it's important to remind people, though, that the Me Too movement started decades ago, and someone who could really claim leadership in this movement was Tarana Burke, who was a black woman from the Bronx who began the the Me Too movement really decades ago. And the idea behind it was for people who had survivors to be able to find each other and support each other. And it's pretty powerful, the work that she's been doing for a long time. And though, unfortunately, I didn't even know about Tarana Burke until after Me Too became the hashtag that it is now, I feel really grateful and proud to be doing some work that I hope is in conjunction with that work that someone like Tarana Burke has been doing for so long.
Now, no, I'd never heard of her either, so.
Yeah.
Brendan, did you model your lead characters after anyone in particular that you like knew from the school or knew from your own life?
Yeah, you know, I really appreciate that question because I think it's important to what I write realistic fiction. And, you know, I don't write about elves, and I don't write about dragons, and part of the responsibility, I think, of someone who is writing realistic fiction is to remember that many of your readers out there are going to see themselves in some way in your characters.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that there are many readers out there who are going to have lived experiences that are like the experiences your characters have. And so I feel an enormous amount of responsibility and accountability to all of those people out there. I want to do their stories justice, and I want to tell their stories in the most empathetic way. And so when I'm working on these characters, it's not as if I'm modeling them off of one person in particular, because I think that could be dangerous. But what I do is I do pull from many real stories out there. One of the inspirations, and this is not her story at all, but an inspiration, was in 2015. That was the year that Emma Salkowitz graduated from Columbia University. And you may remember Emma Salkowitz was that courageous young woman who dragged her mattress onto the stage at graduation at Columbia because she had spent years at Columbia dragging her mattress from class to class in an act of protest. The university did not want to talk about or really reckon with the fact that she had been sexually assaulted. And in her bravery and courage, she would not be silenced. She would not go unheard. And I remember watching those clips of her dragging her mattress onto the stage. And for me, that was part of the inspiration for one of the two narrators of the novel, Jules Devereaux, who's a senior at Fulbrook Academy in the novel. And I think about the courage it must take for someone to say, this happened to me, and not only will I kind of stick my head in the sand, but I want to let folks know that I'm not alone. And in order to do that, I have to drag this mattress around to let folks know that this is the reality for all too many of us. That takes an enormous amount of courage, and
oh,
I tried
my
to
goodness.
Write Jules Devereaux sort of, yeah, honoring her and honoring all the people out there that are like Emma and all the people out there who support her.
Well, what I really enjoyed about reading the book is the way that you presented chapter by chapter. For instance, this chapter for Jules and the next chapter for James. And then, you know, they're in the same place and they're experiencing similar things. But you with those chapters, we can see how they're reacting to each one of those conditions. And
yeah.
I thought that was very interesting.
I thank you. And because I agree. I really love novels that have dual perspective or more than one perspective. And I thought it was really important if I'm going to write a book that is about, you know, misogyny and the culture that really enables it. I thought it was really important to try to write a book from the perspective of a girl and the perspective of a boy.
Mm-hmm.
So we can see the world from both of those perspectives. And so while Jules was one, yeah, the other character had to be a boy. So that's James Baxter.
And it was interesting to me that that James was also an outsider, also had a lot of kind of internal struggles going on. And yet he became Jules' friend and supported her in her activism, and basically was able to stand up to the peer pressure.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's, well, again, if I'm telling stories that are realistic and I'm telling stories that reflect people's real lives, I don't want to only tell stories of horror. I feel really responsible to also tell stories of hope and evolution and growth. Mm-hmm. And for me, so that part of that is if I'm going to tell a story that includes a degree of or an element of or a moment of sexual assault, it's also really important for me to tell a story that includes some moments of consent. And I think that's really important. And this book, and consent, by the way, sometimes it looks like this. I mean, it could be, you know, are you ready for this right now? No. Okay. I hear you. that's all right. And I think kids need to see that on the page. Some adults need to see that on the page too. And likewise, I think for, as you're saying, the way that James Baxter's friendship develops with Jules, you know, part of the book is showing how boys pressure each other to speak about women poorly, how boys pressure each other to think about sexual intimacy in the same way they think about accruing statistics on the sports field, that the way they pressure each other to really behave in you know, what now is called toxic, is also just incredibly aggressive behavior. But also on the flip side, show him developing a real authentic friendship with Jules, one where he is listening, one where he is realizing, hey, I could be part of the problem. So I really appreciate your comment, because that's part of my hope, is that I can show how a person could be pressured on one hand, but make the choices that are necessary to be a more authentic friend and a more whole human being and better listener.
Well, as his role, of course, at the school is as a athlete and so forth, and then, but so he knows the pressure that goes with that, and there's a great deal of pressure with that.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of people realize how much pressure there are on some athletes, and morally and physically, and so, you know, he's got a lot of things to stand up against, really.
It's true. That is very familiar to me in my own life. I was an athlete in high school, and I felt an enormous amount of pressure. Like James in the book, James is on a hockey scholarship, and, you know, he's mm-hmm. at this wealthy boarding school, and he feels totally out of place because he's from blue-collar Ohio, and he's like, what am I doing in this strange environment? And yeah. The high school that I went to was a campus school 45 minutes north of Boston, where I had, you know, grown up. And when I arrived there, I felt totally out of place, and I felt like, what am I doing at this fancy school? And I felt pressure to try to navigate what really felt like strange social customs that I was unaccustomed to, or behaviors, or whatever it might be, in the same way that James does. And when you're an athlete, it's compounded with all that stuff of, you know, you have to be tough, you have to be man about it, and all of these kinds mm-hmm. of things that really, I agree with you, it's an enormous amount of pressure.
Yeah, it really is. I don't think we have any idea about the pressures that young people go through sometimes.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Brendan Keeley, author of Tradition. Brendan, I'd like to explore a little more the kind of the intersection between athletics and these toxic environments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was, as the mother of a son who was an athlete, I thought that his environment, that athletic environment, was toxic to him. He eventually quit because he didn't like it. Even though he loved the sport, he didn't like the cruelty of it. And the character, Baxter, James Baxter, even though he's big and he's strong and he can really cause a lot of damage on the playing field, but he feels very badly about some of the damage that he caused. And
right.
Where do you know, when you're pushing these kids to be tough and hit them and kill them, and you're using this war, this military language, and getting them all riled up, how do we expect them to just then shut that off and be nice people afterwards?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. It is. Well, let me back up one step and say I do think it's important. I'm not anti-sport, right? I think there's an enormous amount of value in team sports, in learning how to be part of a team, in sacrificing some of your own ego for the sake of a team. There are all these pretty important lessons that can be learned from that environment. The problem, however, for me, is when that gets couched in exactly what you're talking about, in a language of sort of militaristic violence. And we could do team building in many ways. When I stopped playing sports for the most part, I ended up joining the drama club, and I may have learned more about team building there than I did in sports. And it is really terrifying to think about. You know, we see all these videos of professional athletes who take their violence off the field and into elevators or with their domestic partners. And we stand here, you know, in our living rooms watching that on the TV screen in shock. But I agree with you. Why are we shocked? We're asking them to be violent for our entertainment. And then we ask them to switch that off. How can you do that? That's pretty hard. You'd have to be incredibly well psychologically trained. And so maybe some people are, but maybe we're not doing a good enough job team building in other ways. Maybe, for example, we could spend more time with our teams working in soup kitchens, building empathy as part of our team building.
That's right.
Yeah, and of course, not all sports require that same type of violent behavior. The two sports that your character played, football and hockey, are two of the most violent sports that kids can be involved in.
But I remember, so I played basketball. I played basketball for most of my life before I realized that being 6'2" was not tall. I'll never forget this one practice in high school where we were running and running and running and we were just running so hard, and our coach was yelling, and I ran right off the court and I vomited in the water fountain, and I wiped my mouth with my shirt and I ran back onto the court, and nobody batted an eye. There wasn't an "Are you okay?" It was "Get right back in there. Are you tough enough to get back in there?" And then another kid ran off the court and vomited and came back on. And so even if it's not football or hockey, I think that sensibility of, it's not even just conditioning, it's kind of it's something much deeper and aggressive, and kind of weeding out those who are weaker than others.
My son in junior high school hurt his finger in a football game. The coach made him go back in and play. He had a broken finger.
Yeah. I mean, these are kids.
Yeah. He was like 13.
Yeah. I don't think that we learn the lesson that the coaches are hoping we learn in that moment.
No. And it makes me wonder about the coaches.
Yeah. Well, and that's something that I think is really important too. So one of the things that I've found that I'm really grateful about is that I was talking with a wrestling coach in actually outside of Dallas when I was just beginning my tour for Tradition, and he really likes the book, and he thinks that you can use the book and to help athletes, and especially male athletes, begin to critique their own kind of, toxic, misogynistic environment. And what he hopes is that many athletes and teams will embrace the book and do a book club. But what he said was, you know, we do a lot of work. He's like, my athletes will do anything for me because they're so devoted to me. He said, if I said, go burn that other teacher's car, they'd go do it. And if that's the kind of environment that and the power that coaches have, imagine what they could do if they were the ones to say, it's on our shoulders to help this society become less misogynistic. What
Use
if they
your
took
power
on that
for
challenge?
Good.
Yes! Exactly. Wow. I would love that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Wow. Now, is this the first time that you've written from a female perspective in tradition, or have you done that in your prior books as well?
It's the first time in one of my published books. I've done that before in short stories and in various exercises in graduate school and whatnot. But this is the first time that it's sort of the real deal. It's half a book, and I do have to say that I was incredibly nervous. I'm still pretty nervous, but I, again, as I was saying before, I feel very accountable to people and potential readers, and so I had 9 women reading over my shoulder, giving me feedback as I, wrote the book and really helping me think. And 2 of those women, in fact, are crisis counselors and rape crisis counselors. And so there was. I think it's really important that I'm not a woman, so I don't have that firsthand experience as the 2 of you do. So it's important for me, I think, to be walking the walk and listening to feedback
right,
as I work on
right.
this book.
I know. There's nothing quite as annoying as a man writing from a female perspective, and he's writing what right. men want women to be like, not what women are actually like.
Mm.
Yeah, that happens a lot, doesn't it?
Yep. I think that is... That's important for all us male writers to hear.
Yeah.
I'm curious. Do you come across that sort of all too often?
I would say more with amateur writers, mm-hmm. not so much with books that make it to publication. But occasionally, there's certainly are. In the past, particularly, a lot of published writers who whose female characters are more male fantasies than real characters.
Yeah.
I'm remembering when I was like in high school, I started reading Robert Heinlein, and I thought he was really good until I realized, wait a minute, the women in here are not real characters.
Yeah. Well. And on some level, I feel like that speaks to the very problem of an overly misogynistic culture, right? That men they lack the empathy and imagination to really step into that space of a woman's experience. I rarely have I read a book by a woman where I felt like the men didn't seem real. and maybe, like I say, that speaks to part of the problem.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Better listener.
I think you're right.
Well, why do you think that is? That women can see men as they are, but men can't see women as they are. Why do you think that is?
You know, I think it goes back to this. The, just like in the book, the way that the boys are asking each other to become men. In ways that they think are, I am a man by not being this, which I'm calling a woman, but that thing that is this is made up. It's their fear of not being man enough. For me, I'm just wildly speculating here. I'd be so curious to hear what you think. But I think that men too often construct their masculinity in ways that are anti-woman. And that's part of the problem. They haven't even taken the time to imagine the individual. If you're making a blanket statement of, oh, don't throw like a girl. Oh, you know, man up. That's the kind of language that already creates part of the problem.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I remember watching Saturday Night Live and the girly man comments. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Interesting, isn't that? It's really interesting when you think about it.
That was, in fact, one of the scenes in the novel where James is thinking about his friendship with Jules. And he was talking about how he's like, oh, you know, hanging out with Jules is kind of like hanging out with all the guys, except with less pressure, and it feels like we're actually listening to each other.
Well, speaking of listening, you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Brendan Keeley, author of Tradition, which is a young adult novel set in an elite private school and addresses the misogyny and culture around sexual assault that is perhaps all too common in some of these institutions.
Yeah, I was curious about that. Do you think that really, really, truly happens where the freshman girls are thrown in with the senior boys just off the bus? I mean, I just can hardly believe that.
Well, I did research at a number of boarding schools, and I went to the campuses. I talked to people. I did research, you know, by interviewing alumni from a variety of boarding schools, and it's shocking to hear that these traditions still go on today, where seniors, both the boys and the girls, take first years or freshmen to the to a semi-formal dance. And while on the surface it sounds like, oh, this is like supposed to be cute, like the first year students, they don't know anyone yet, and it's, you know, it's embarrassing to try to get a date and whatnot, and the seniors can take care of them. But instead, of course, it sets up an awful power dynamic. And too many of the men, those senior boys, really take advantage of their position of power. We've seen some pretty high-profile cases about that recently in the last couple of years as well, and there was a lot of discussion about what happened at St. Paul's in New Hampshire. And Chessie Prout, who actually has recently published a memoir of her experience at that boarding school, has a very similar story to tell, and it's her true story.
Are the administrations at these schools starting to look at this and thinking, duh?
Yeah, that was my next question too. What are these people in charge? Where are they?
Well, you know, this is not the same equivalent, but I do want to say there is something I find similar about the administration in Tradition and at schools in general, as I find problematic in some ways with our law enforcement as an overall institution, and as we wrote about in Jason Reynolds and I wrote about in All American Boys, and likewise some of the same issues that I had with the Catholic Church that I wrote about in The Gospel of Winter, that institutions that really, for lack of a better way of putting it, kind of circle the wagons and protect themselves before being open to critique, being transparent with how they're going to make the necessary changes to keep all people that they serve safe. Mm-hmm. And I take issue with all those institutions similarly. And I think that it's unfortunate when school administrators might give lip service to Title IX, and they might talk about how they're going to address issues of sexual harassment. But just as I was mentioning earlier, you know, at Columbia University, Emma Salkowitz certainly didn't feel like she was being taken seriously enough. that her case was being taken seriously enough. And I think that's true not just in schools. I mean, I wrote about a school because I often write about young adults, and the institutions they're a part of primarily are schools. But this novel could have been set in a workplace. It could have been set at a summer camp. It could have been set probably at any institution in America, and you'd find women who have similar stories.
I like that you used that, you know, the assault that that Jules experienced was not necessarily entirely clear cut.
Yeah.
I don't want to give too much away, but, you know, the circumstances around it were murky, which they often are in these situations.
Yes.
And so she at first felt, was it her fault?
Mm-hmm.
Which is very common, too. It's perhaps easier to think or write about something where, you know, a stranger leaps out of the woods, holds somebody at knife point, and then disappears. And that something like that would get an immediate response from the administration and everybody around.
Right. Hopefully.
Hopefully.
I cannot tell you how much I appreciate that comment and question, because nobody in all the interviews that I've had so far has really brought that up, and I think it's one of the most important parts of the book. So I can't tell you how grateful I am, because I think it's essential. It's too easy to when we say the word rape, it's too easy to paint that picture that you just did in our minds, when in fact the definition is much broader. It isn't always strangers. In fact, statistically, it's more true that it's people that you know who are the rapists, in fact. It's also true that it's not always the degree to which it affects a person isn't always with a kind of brutality and violence with, like you said, well, weapon. I mean, it can be much murkier. And that's precisely why I hope to have conversations about consent in this book and also in The Last True Love Story, because we have to get away from thinking that our conversations about sex are about listening for the word no. Instead, we should be talking about how we can ask people questions, and so that yes can be the operative word as we proceed through moments of sexual intimacy, and that's perfectly okay. there's nothing wrong with that. And so I deeply appreciate your point there, because it is murky, and people are then confused afterwards. And many of the women that I spoke to as I was working on the book, you know, they said this has happened more than once. This has happened many times, and I've felt confused. I think men have to do a good job reflecting back on their own experiences too, and think, you know, when have I not really paid attention in the moment as maybe I should have? Because we can do better. I think we can do better.
The chapter where Jules is speaking, I could believe that a woman was writing that. So I think you did a really good job of capturing the female perspective.
Well, thank you. And again, I certainly didn't do it alone. I have 9 women in the acknowledgments, that I think.
Well, what I really admire women like Jules and like Emma that you spoke of at Columbia, who are willing to just keep standing up and standing out and making their voices heard, even when they aren't getting support from the people around them. Jules from day one was trying to make a difference, to bring out issues, and to not just quietly, passively go along with the way things were. It's hard if you've got people that have your back and it's a whole team. It's still hard, but it's a little easier to do it. But if you're the only one, man, that takes some immense self-confidence to be able to do that.
I agree. I mean, let's talk about strength here for a second. Forget man up, jewels up.
Yeah, really.
Those are the kinds of students that I remember teaching. There were, you know, there were always a handful every year of these young women who, to me, it felt like they were seeking out the responsibility to sort of shoulder the big issues of our day, and they're courageous. They want to ask us all, like, why aren't we doing better with healthcare? Why aren't we doing better with housing in New York City? Why aren't we? And it was strong, courageous young women. And that's I was hoping to write that kind of a character for Jules, because I think sometimes in these kinds of stories we see women who are painted in a kind of way that makes them seem like victims, or makes them seem like wallflowers or whatnot. And I wanted to say, no, I mean, really incredibly strong women are up against misogyny all the time. You could say run for president and always hit the wall of misogyny.
You think?
And you have to be a pretty strong woman to run for president.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You must be really thrilled with what the Parkland survivors are doing.
Oh my gosh. I talk about heroes. I mean, it is, and it's unfortunate, right? Because I was attending a benefit recently in which some of those students were being honored. And as one of them said, I shouldn't have to be here to accept this award. I shouldn't be a national hero right now. I should be attending graduation with more of my classmates. And that was powerful. But I do recognize at the same time, yeah, I'm stunned and proud of these student leaders. The Emma Gonzalez's of the world are out there, and I think we need to really we need to do a better job giving credit where credit's due. I mean, these kids are asking us to change the national conversation right now, and they're doing it. I mean, it's
absolutely
it's remarkable.
And from what I understand, they have had the support of their administration and their teachers, and were really kind of, even before any of this happened, they were being taught how to stand up, how to speak out.
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
I agree. Yeah. And so likewise, I wish that we would embrace an honest conversation about misogyny and the kind of culture that enables sexual assault, because if you look at the statistics, we live in a very violent culture, and we should be teaching our kids to speak up and stand up and speak out in the same way about this issue, because this is a staggering statistic, but the number of women who die in 3 years' time due to domestic violence is greater than the number of people who died on September 11th. That's a staggering statistic in our country.
Oh my gosh.
And it's something that because we don't talk about it, we never really address. So if we begin to talk about this with real honesty, I think we could see young people with the same kind of courage right now that are speaking up about Parkland and about, you know, gun control. I would love to see a generation speaking up about our own problems with gender violence. It'd be powerful, and I would stand with them.
Absolutely. Well, Brendan, let's talk a little bit more about your writing process. Now, when we spoke with you before, you were co-writing, you know, so that had its own challenges and opportunities. What's your writing process like when you're writing a book by yourself? Do you plot it out before you start writing, or do you start out with a concept and just see where it leads you?
So I wish we were, you know, doing doing this over video because you can see the size of my grin as you as you ask the question, because it's it certainly changes a little bit for each book, but really I do. My mother used to say, "Brendan, you always do things the hard way. It's not a door. It's a wall." and I think when writing a novel, I sometimes take the same approach. I get lost, and maybe that's okay. And I spend a lot of time starting with character. I try to get to know the characters again, because I'm working on pieces that are realistic. I want to do justice, and I want to get to know these people as I would as if they were real people. And sometimes that means writing a whole number of scenes that will never end up getting used in the novel, but now I feel like they've become more multidimensional than at first. And I wrote chapters of this book until I arrived at what now is the first line for each of the two narrators. And once I arrived at that line, I threw everything else out and started from scratch. And then I have goalposts in mind. Like, I know there's going to be a party in the woods. I know there's going to be a theme that involves, you know, some kind of act of protest. I know there's going to be a scene where there's an escape from the school for a breath of fresh air. And that's about it. And I sort of very slowly make my way to those goalposts.
Well, Brendan, before we run out of time, would you please read to us from Tradition?
Oh, absolutely. I would love to. And I'm, excuse me. I'd love to start right from the beginning, if that's okay.
That sounds great.
And I'm going to give everybody a little sense of the two perspectives, and I'll just, before I move into the different voice, I'll just say the character's name. So the book begins like this. For the record, James Baxter. Most people don't get second chances. I wasn't sure I deserved one. I wasn't sure I even wanted one, but I got one. Fulbrook Academy. This is what I did with it. For the record, Jules Devereaux. I once heard another girl put it like this. This is a boys' school, and they accept girls here, too. At Fulbrook, they told us to be ready to take on the world, but then they told us to do it quietly. What if I wanted to be loud? What if I needed to be? The night everything changed. Jules Devereaux. I'm fighting for breath, and all I can do is look up and see the white flame of moonlight outlining each branch, every leaf. I'm in the dirt, again, shoulder against the tree, the shock of air so cold it seizes my bones. I can still feel his grip on my arm, as if he's still here, shackling me to the trunk with his hands and his weight, but he's not. He's gone. I'm so cold. I'm shaking, but it feels like it's this tree and the sky above that are shaking, that are blurry, unreal, no longer what they were. It's as if I'm naked, but I'm not. It's as if the ground is swinging up to slap me, but it's not. I collapse by the edge of the bluff. There are still voices in the woods behind me, voices down along the far end of the bluff, voices in the night air like invisible birds screeching in the wind. There's a voice inside me, too. It's mine, I think, but it doesn't sound like me. It's me, and it's not me. It grows louder and louder, barking, bellowing up from somewhere and squeezing my head with noise. It's me, and it isn't. Or it's me splitting in two, and this other voice, this new voice, keeps shouting, run, it says, run, 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 I'm so close to the cliff edge, I could crawl forward and drop, crouch one knee by the side of the pool, like I did when I first learned to dive, but I'm hundreds of feet in the air, and the voice tells me to back up. I obey. It tells me to stand, and I use the tree to help me to my feet. Run, it says again, and I do, into the woods, down the far path, away from the party, away from the other voices, away from everyone. I know where I'm going, but I still feel lost, alone. I just want to get home, though the word means nothing now. Just because I live there doesn't mean it's somewhere safe. The night everything changed. James Baxter. I can't believe this, but I'm so out of breath, I have to crouch down and lean against the back wall of the girls' dorm just to put some air in my lungs. Damn, it hurts. But you can't lug a passed-out person through the woods, across campus, get her up through the bathroom window, and not want to collapse, even if you're me, and even if I did get some help. I know she thinks I'm an asshole, and I didn't do it to change her mind. I just did it because it was the right thing to do, and I knew it was the right thing to do, and it was the first time in a year I'd felt so certain I knew right from wrong, that I had to do the right thing and forget all the rest. If you care about a person, my ex-girlfriend used to tell me, don't just tell her, show her, show up, listen, and act so she knows you heard her. Seems so simple the way she put it, but it's never that simple. An avalanche of other pressures buries that wisdom most days, all days, except this night when, for some reason, I heard that advice strong and true, like a wind through the eaves of the old wooden rooftop above me. Way up in the sky, the man in the moon has something like sad eyes, as if his pale face gazes down with pity, as if he wishes something better for us, or maybe wishes we ourselves were the ones who were better. I'm sure I'm sober, not drunk, just going a little crazy to think like that, but I think it anyway, because I feel that way, sad, like this whole stupid paradise. This very good school is nothing but a fancy promise, a broken one, a big lie, and worse, that I'm actually a part of it. I think I'll stop there.
Oh, see? Now you got them hooked. You got them hooked. They're going to buy the book.
And that was Brendan Keeley reading from Tradition. When was Tradition released?
It was published on May 1st, 2018.
All so right. So you're there now. Must be right in the midst of your book tour.
I am. And it's been a pretty spectacular book tour to talk to young people all across the country, from Texas to Connecticut to Massachusetts to Chicago. It's been pretty spectacular.
Are you, I'm assuming you're getting pretty positive responses from kids.
I am, and it's been pretty humbling to be in conversation with kids who say, yeah, that's exactly what I feel like when I walk down the hall, or yeah, that's something that I recognize in the locker room, or yeah, this is real. And it's been humbling because as I remember when touring All American Boys, Jason and I would share pieces of the novel, and people would stand up in the audience and they would tell us their stories. Well, likewise, mm-hmm. I'm touring around right now and talking about Tradition. It's pretty humbling to begin to tell the story of Tradition and listen to young people and people who are not so young stand up and share their stories that are all too similar to what's going on in Tradition.
By the way, I met Jason briefly in Dallas, or excuse me, in Austin last fall at the Texas Book Festival.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that's a cool event. Do you think you'll be there this year?
I will be there. I'll be at the Texas Book Festival this coming fall.
Awesome. I may be there. I live part-time in Austin, so I try and go if I'm in town.
Oh, yeah. I would love it.
Yeah. I'll definitely look for you if I make it.
Please do.
I'm wondering if anybody, any young person who reads the book will take an inspiration by the spectacular event that Jules and James and her friends did at the last to let everybody know how they felt. I'm not going to tell them what happened, but it was spectacular, and you know, and it didn't hurt anybody. There was no damage to anybody. It was just spectacular.
Exactly. I hope so, and I have to say, I recently got forwarded a couple of photos that were taken at a school that's actually in the Austin area, and the students had written some graffiti on the wall that surrounds part of the football field, it looks like, or maybe it's another part of the school, I'm not sure. But that graffiti was an act of protest about what's going on and that people aren't talking about. Mm. So my hope is that, in fact, we embrace our democratic sense of dissent in order to help a culture create authentic community conversation. That would be a heck of an honor.
This would be a
great place to start the conversation.
Yeah.
With tradition.
Well, thank you.
So, Brendan, we only have a couple of minutes. What subject are you planning to tackle next?
that's right. I'm always pursuing something, right? It's hard for me to talk about a project when I'm in the middle of it because, as I said before, I take a long time and I get lost. So, I don't want to misspeak. But I will say that I hope that in the next year or two, people will be able to find books of mine that are similarly interested in social justice issues, but are written for an even younger age group, and also one that is really all about adults.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Wow.
I think literature can really be a vehicle for conversations about empathy at any age. And whether you're someone who is a young person who's recognizing her or his place in the world for the first time, or you're someone who's older who's reflecting on the wider world in a new way, there are always opportunities for us to develop a stronger sense of empathy, and I think books are a great place to do that.
And I agree with that, and I also think that books and movies in particular, in the way that they have portrayed romantic relationships in the past, have contributed to the problem. There are so many movies where a male character gets turned down by a woman and then continues to pursue her until she finally gives in and they all live happily ever after.
And I agree. It's terrible.
I saw a tweet the other day where someone said, my nephew told me about this girl that he asked out and she turned him down. And I said, well, what do you do now? And he goes, I know, keep trying. And she goes, no, you leave her alone.
Right.
She gave you her answer. Move on.
Exactly.
That is not the message that kids have gotten from so many books and movies in the past.
That's true.
I completely, completely agree. And it's not funny, even though that's the formula for so many romantic comedies.
Exactly.
It's not okay. And instead,
you've got to start
here. It would be great
here,
if we told those boys to cry and enjoy their tears for a little bit. It's okay.
Well, I think this book would make a great movie myself.
It would. So, Mom, we're out of time. Do you have some closing words for us
today? Oh, gosh. Well, girls and women, support one another. And don't be afraid to stand up and say no.
I also really like the quote that's at the front of this book from Arundhati Roy. There's really no such thing as the voiceless. There are only the deliberately silenced or the preferably unheard.
Oh, excellent.
Wow. Well, thank you for being with us, Brendan.
Thank you very much. This has been a ball.
For us, too. And for all you out there listening, see you next week on Writers' Voices.